I think Ingrid kind of became this vessel for us to pour all of our conflicting feelings about social media and Instagram into. We sort of asked ourselves, like, who's the worst person that Instagram could happen to? And I think Ingrid's kind of the answer to that question.
Director Matt Spicer's film Ingrid Goes West took away the top screenwriting award at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's been hailed as a darkly funny satire about today's obsession with social media, but as we'll hear from Spicer himself, it's less about the media and more about the people who use it. Hello from Midori House in London. This is The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. Also today,
I went to a party and somebody came over and said, who are you? And I said, my coach. He said, yes, I've just met the scriptwriter. I said, oh, really, have you? So I look around and I think, who the hell's posing as the scriptwriter? Because I'd written the script.
Fresh from the success of the classic crime film Get Carter, starring Michael Caine in 1971, director Mike Hodges began work on the comedy thriller Pulp. We'll find out whatever happened to the almost forgotten favourite in a special interview with the filmmaker. That's all to come on The Cinema Show on Monocle 24.
Live in the sunshine, swim in the sea, drink the wild air. Ralph Waldo Emerson. My muse, hashtag Roscoe the dog. There's science, logic, and reason. And then there is California. Baby, you're a firework. American flag emoji. You're so cool. Hashtag true romance vibes.
Some people might be confused by the premise set forth in Matt Spicer's debut film, Ingrid Goes West. Is it a film about mental illness? Perhaps. But it's more concerned with the everyday banality of social media and how such tools of connectivity can be used to fill in for real human connections. From its opening scene, it's clear that Ingrid is an unstable protagonist. When she's not spending her time in an institution following a violent outburst, she's at home in suburbia, in the home that she once shared with her now deceased mother. It's a sad existence. Easy to understand then why the endless scroll of opportunities offered by Instagram's sun-drenched influencers might suggest an alluring quick fix. You too can be your best self, they say. Happiness is just a few hundred followers away. The pitfalls of social media are well documented, but Matt Spicer's film cleverly avoids falling into the social commentary mode by focusing his film not on the ills of Instagram, but on the emotional weaknesses that these apps can often prey upon with their economies of likes and double taps. Despite the ubiquity of social media, it's rare for a film to expose the medium with such a fine balance of honesty and comedy. I asked Matt Spicer where the suggestion for the story came from.
So Dave, my co-writer, and I, we were having lunch in Los Angeles, and he's a screenwriter too, and it was just a friendly lunch, and we just started talking about social media, and specifically Instagram, and how we both have this kind of love-hate relationship with it, that we both use it a lot, and we're fans of the app, but it tends to dredge up the darker sides of ourselves that maybe we wouldn't want to admit exist, you know, our sort of insecurities and things where we're looking at what people post and thinking, oh, are we not going on enough vacations? Or are we not wearing cool enough clothes? Or, you know, like things like that. And so I think Ingrid kind of became this vessel for us to pour all of our conflicting feelings about social media and Instagram into. She's sort of the, we sort of asked ourselves, like, who's the worst person that Instagram could happen to? You know, and it's, I think Ingrid's kind of the answer to that question.
And she feels like a very authentic character. I think most people will look at her and think, oh, I know someone just like that. Hopefully not just like that,
because right.
She is quite an extreme example.
Yeah.
But if you take away some of the real extremities that managed to make the plot of the film push along, there are so many facets to her that feel like little bits and pieces we notice in everyday life and in everyday experiences that we have. Is that part of how she was shaped for you? Did you draw upon experiences that you'd actually had coming into contact with other people?
I think it's a hodgepodge. You know, I think it's like you pull from parts of yourself, a darker part of yourself that you want to explore, maybe people that I've known in the past. And then also, I don't want to discount Aubrey's contribution to the character, because I think you write one thing on the page and then you need an actor to bring it to life. And I think Aubrey did such a great job of playing all these different sides and really, I think, making her such a well-rounded character that you really feel like you care about her, even though she's doing all these kind of desperate things that you maybe don't approve of, you know, or you're like, please don't do that. You know, it's like sort of that horror movie thing of like, oh, don't open that door or whatever. We wanted the character to be very three-dimensional. We didn't want her to be a joke, or we didn't want her to be sort of the sinister villain of the film. You know, we wanted her to have all these different facets of her character.
I mean, this is very much a film of the moment, of course. It's about someone who hungers after social media fame more than anything else. Even maybe not just fame, but just the validation existing in this make-believe world. And yet, if you take away that social media aspect, we're really left with one of those timeless stories about quite often a female character who is existing in this world that's not necessarily built for her, and she just wants to carve a place, and she's going about it in all the wrong ways. In some ways, I was reminded of some of the classic film noirs where you had a femme fatale who would go to extreme lengths to do some very, very devilish sorts of things, and you find yourself kind of hoping she succeeds, but then questioning why you want her to succeed when she's such a terrible person.
Right.
Is that sort of moral ambiguity something that you were trying to tap into as well?
For sure. I love film noirs, but usually, you know, the female character is there to tempt the male character, you know, the virtuous male into ruin. And I think, you know, a lot of the films that we're referencing, like The King of Comedy or Chuck and Buck or Towns of Mr. Ripley, you know, there are a lot of male anti-heroes, and I think we wanted to add a female anti-hero to the canon of hopefully these sort of classic just anti-hero characters. But it was definitely something that was on our minds, you know, and especially the way we shot L.A. was, you know, L.A. is a very noir, you know, a lot of film noirs take place there. And, you know, Bunker Hill is like a famous sort of neighborhood in L.A. that where a lot of them were set. But the idea of like the night aspect of it is that there's two L.A.s, right? There's the sunny, bright L.A. and then there's the more dark and sinister night version of L.A. And that was definitely a conscious decision that we made.
Talk to me more about that setting then, because that it feels as though it's a film that couldn't have taken place anywhere else. Because of, I've visited Los Angeles, but I've never lived there. But so many people will talk to you about this city being the city of facades. You scratch the surface and you just don't find very much. I mean, look, I don't necessarily agree with that, but a lot of people do feel that way. It's the vacuous city. Is that the backdrop you needed?
I've lived there for 15 years now, and I think you have to kind of live there to really appreciate the finer points of LA. And it took me a long time, I think, to really appreciate the city in a way that I hadn't before, because everyone's familiar with the surface aspects of it. But there's a lot of amazing little restaurants hidden away or little things, and it's usually the things that aren't in plain sight that are what's great about LA. And everyone's always has their little secret spots that is why they love LA. I wanted to capture that and show, I think thematically LA made sense because there are these two sides to it. And, you know, the idea of Instagram is that we put this one version out. There's the surface level of which we think we know people, right? We just scroll through their feed and we think we understand, we know this person. But then there's also the reality that you see that's outside the frame. And so there's that duality to Los Angeles that I think thematically made a lot of sense for sure.
One of the things that I think your film depicts so perfectly is how everything in life can sometimes just become one big popularity contest, whether it's being invited to a party, whether it's just having the right friends. And Instagram seems to have taken that and it kind of assembled it into the perfect streamlined machine of popularity contests. It's the ultimate graduation of the American Idol style television show, sort of making everything achievable in the realm of social media. How did that transform into this story for you? Because you speak about Instagram being the beast of the film, but there's also quite a rich story going on here, and we get introduced to a character. Talk to me about the process of it becoming an actual story.
Well, it's funny that you said, I think Instagram's quantified. It's like not only is it a popularity contest, but there's actually a number attached to it, right? You have this many followers, and so you can actually say, oh, this person's more popular than this person. And we have proof because there's the number right there next to their name. So that kind of makes it, I think, much more harrowing. It makes me worry about the younger generation because it's like if middle school wasn't harrowing enough to then also have social media on top of it, making you feel even worse about yourself or maybe even more uncool or whatever. But in terms of the story, I mean, I think, you know, it started from the character and then it was sort of looking at, well, how can we maybe surprise the audience and send the film off into a different direction? So I think, not to give any spoiler alert, but, you know, halfway through the film when Ingrid and Taylor become friends, I think people are a little surprised by that. They're like, oh, I thought this was going to be the whole movie was them. And now they're already hanging out and they become best friends. And so where's the movie going to go from here? We wanted to sort of play with people's expectations of where they thought the story was going to go a little bit.
And yet, even when they become friends, well, I didn't feel like they were actual friends because, as you suggest, right, it happens. It's such a transactional moment where it's almost as though she's walked into the right shop and picked up an item and somehow they've sold it to her and she's somewhat surprised but happy to be walking away with the item that she wanted. I mean, that's part of it, isn't it? That's a key part of what's going on here. They're not relationships that are being formed. They're almost like business agreements.
Well, transactional is the right word. I think there, it's like when, again, not to keep talking about middle school or high school, but it's the same sort of dynamics where there's like the cool kid and then there's his sidekick, you know, and they're both getting something out of that. You know, the cool kid's getting something out of having someone to laugh at all his jokes and make him feel important and cool. And then the sidekick, it's like you're cool by association. So it's like they're both getting something out of it. And I'm glad that you picked up on that because that was definitely the intention of showing that Ingrid's wouldn't exist without the Taylors to sort of feed them this stuff. And I think there is that aspect of when people turn themselves into brands, quote unquote, you turn your life into a commercial. Well, you're selling that product to certain people. And of course, there's going to be, not to say that anyone who's an influencer deserves to have stalkers, but I think to a certain degree, you invite it in when you commodify yourself like that. It's like, well, you don't know what you're, who's out there and what they're going to read into it or whatever, you know what I mean? And so you're, again, not asking for it, but it's two sides to the same coin, I guess.
I would suggest that there's maybe one character in the film who starts to form what seems like it could be an actual authentic relationship with one of the characters. It might be the only actual authentic relationship we see in the film. We wouldn't be spoiling it for it to suggest that it doesn't necessarily go the way that you might describe a happy ending to go. But I came away thinking that's actually quite interesting because this film, it by its very definition, needs to be fairly vacuous. It needs to be full of people who don't really know how to talk to each other in an authentic way because they're spending the whole film chasing something that is by its definition not real. Is the cure then for what we're talking about simply talking to each other and forming actual relationships that don't rely on some invention to take place?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's what the Dan Pinto character, who I'm guessing is who you're referencing, but that, you know, that was the intention behind that character. Is that here's a guy who, he's obsessed with Batman, and he loves probably one of the least popular Batman movies, which is Batman Forever. And, you know,
loved that, by the way. As soon as that business card popped up in the Batman Forever font, I thought, what, that's definitely a reference. That's not accidental.
Definitely not an accident. But I liked having a character who isn't cool and who likes what he likes and isn't doing it to be popular, you know, and I think to have a character who is authentic and is very much himself, and to have that to contrast with all these characters who are all trying to be somebody that they're not and pretend to be somebody that they're not. And so that's sort of the point of that character, is that she's, meanwhile, while Ingrid's chasing all this, these mirages, there's a real person here who really cares about her and sees her for who she is and likes her for who she is, and that she's really not appreciating. And to me, I sort of see, just to talk about the ending, I see the ending as bittersweet. I don't see it as a completely hopeless ending, but obviously it's not, things aren't completely rosy in the end, and it's not the sort of happy ending that maybe people want. But again, referencing the film noirs that you said before, you know, that's sort of the ending of every film noir. It's like, you know, it ends with the main character either in complete ruin or on the verge of ruin. And I think those movies came out of a very anxious sort of post-war mentality of like the future was very uncertain for a lot of people. And so I think that's, you know, I feel like that's where, at least where my head space was at while we were making the film, is not knowing what the future holds and that we could potentially be on the precipice of something really bad. So hopefully it serves as a wake-up call for some people to sort of evaluate their own use of social media and how that relates to, you know, their relationships in real life.
A couple of ground rules, okay?
Okay.
I need you to tell everyone that you're my boyfriend. It's a long story, but I just need you to
I get it. I see that you dig me. I dig you. I'll be your boyfriend. Okay. I'll be your boyfriend.
Okay, whatever. And also, no Batman talk.
What am I supposed to talk about? I don't know these people.
Something cool, like food or clothes or Joan Didion.
Okay.
Matt Spicer, director of Ingrid Goes West, which is out in cinemas this week. Still to come, I will sit down for a special interview with the director of the classic film Get Carter, starring Michael Caine. That's Mike Hodges coming up soon. But first, a word from the news desk.
The Harvey Weinstein scandal has prompted companies in the film industry and beyond to reevaluate their stance on sexual harassment in the workplace. The Swedish Film Institute today announced its plans to introduce mandatory education for sexual conduct for all companies that want to apply to its production fund. The move is in response to news that nearly 600 Swedish actresses, including Oscar winner Alicia Vikander, signed a letter exposing harassment incidents throughout the Swedish industry. And the film experts at MUBI have put together a standout list of titles this week, including a film by the always controversial director Darren Aronofsky. Romance-turned-metaphysical epic The Fountain stars Rachel Weisz and Hugh Jackman, graced by gold-hued cinematography. MUBI is the curated movie site of cult, classic, and award-winning films. Sample a month for free by heading to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. I'm Daphne Karnesis, and this is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned.
From the opening scene in the classic 1971 film Get Carter, it's clear that we're in pulp fiction territory. Seated in the cabin of a train, a very dapper Michael Caine closes a copy of Raymond Chandler's Farewell, My Lovely, and steps out into the hall en route to the dining cart. Soon, the train reaches its destination, and Jack Carter is let loose into the streets of his hometown. Like so many of the films directed by Mike Hodges, Get Carter was a gem out of its time. Upon its release, British critics were mystified by its hard-boiled style, bemoaning its depiction of violence and cold anti-hero. The film found some friends on the other side of the Atlantic, however, where its mix of noir storytelling and on-trend British style appealed to moviegoers. Following the success of Get Carter, Mike Hodges went on to make a mixed bag of hidden gems and strange delights, including the absurdly fun 1980 film adaptation of the Flash Gordon comic strip, featuring a tremendous musical score by Queen. But it's perhaps Hodges' second film that received the saddest fate. Pulp again starred Michael Caine, this time as Mickey King, a writer of cheap paperback novels, who finds himself embroiled in a real-life pulp story of murder and mystery when he's employed to ghostwrite the autobiography of a mysterious celebrity in a remote island kingdom. Hodges managed to convince two stars of old Hollywood to step out of retirement for the project, Mickey Rooney and legend of the noir genre, Elizabeth Scott. But after faltering at the box office, the film quickly faded and today is largely forgotten. Pulp is thankfully now receiving a release on Blu-ray. Here's Mike Hodges taking us back to the making of the mysterious and almost forgotten film.
It's a curious film. I mean, the genesis is a slightly odd one in the sense that after Get Carter, Michael Caine, Michael Klinger, wanted to work with me again. So I insisted that I could write an original screenplay, as I'd done on television before. And they wanted to commission it, but I wouldn't have that because I wanted to write the script. If they liked it, then we'd do it. If they didn't like it, then that was that. So the genesis basically was that at the time in Italy, the local elections had happened. And to my utter astonishment, we're talking about 1969, the fascist party re-emerged. In fact, of course, it never gone away. But as somebody who was brought up in the war and so as a young person had sort of witnessed the coverage of the concentration camps and everything, you just couldn't conceive of that it's such a horrible policy could ever extend to survive in this. So that was the sort of the starting point. Then I put it together with a very strange scandal that had happened some years before called the Montesi scandal. And the Montesi scandal was a young woman who's found dead on a beach near Rome. And then the whole story was blown up. It was the beginning of the paparazzi, this story. It ran for 10 years and everybody was involved. Everyone had said the Pope was involved, actors were involved. There was a sort of the Wizard of Naples or wherever it was, you know, who was a sort of soothsayer, and he was brought in. It was an absolute farce and it continued for 10 years. Anyway, so I involved, that became a part of the story. So I went to Mussolini's tomb and I got the idea of there's a little record player outside, a jukebox out, just a small one outside his tomb where he'd play his speeches. I went into a shop there where I asked if there was anything Vel Duce and underneath, of course, quite illegally, they brought out LPs and photographs of Mussolini and so on. So all of this built up and that's really basically what the story was about. I was going to shoot it in Italy, but what happened was that when I went to look at all the locations, the production manager said, well, of course, here we'll have to pay off the mafia. So I went everywhere. And each time he said, we'll have to look after. Well, of course, it was like being in my own film because I rang the producer and said, look, I think we're going to be taken to the cleaners here if we shoot in Italy. So I said, I know Malta very well. Why don't we shoot there? So he very bravely, in my opinion, because it was only like 4 weeks before we were starting shooting, he said, OK, let's shoot in Malta.
So then you chose an interesting cast for this, and I understand that originally Mickey Rooney wasn't cemented to be in the, well, semi-lead, I suppose, supporting character. You were searching for someone else to be in that role.
No, I had a terrible fight to get them to accept Mickey Rooney. The point of the character is he's small, and he played all these gangsters. And all the gangster stars, most of them anyway, were small men. There was Alan Ladd, Mickey Rooney himself. And one of the whole joke of the film is partly the fact that he is so small. And there are a lot of jokes about this fact. Now, I wanted Mickey Rooney, but the United Artists, who were the distributors, were reluctant to have him. And I just insisted that we had him. They were suggesting people like Victor Mature, who's about 6'3", and he said, well, have you read the script? There's all these jokes about this man being so small, exactly like Mussolini was and Hitler. And they're all small men. One of the ironies is that a lot of dictators and a lot of gangster film stars in those days were small. And that was part of the script and the joke of the script.
I think a lot of the stories surrounding the making of this film have been mistranslated, perhaps, over time, and we'll get to another one of them in a moment, but I had read a couple of rumours or a couple of reports floating around various different sources to say that you wanted Robert Mitchum to be in the role that went to Mickey Rooney, but clearly that is untrue as well.
Absolutely ridiculous, of course. It's funny how these rumours start. Where did you hear that? I mean, really curious.
I won't actually say the source right now, but that is something that has been reported.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, there's a very funny story. When I went to a party in Malta where we were shooting the film, it was near the end of the film. And somebody came over and said, who are you? And I said, Mike Hodges. He said, yes, I've just met the scriptwriter. I said, oh, really, have you? So I look around and I think, who the hell's posing as the scriptwriter? Because I'd written the script, right? So he went in as a prop man. And he was actually chatting up all the girls saying he'd written it. So you see how these rumours can easily start.
So one of the other most fascinating parts about Pulp is that it became this forgotten film. But you also featured an actress in the film who I'm not sure if by the 70s she was completely forgotten by then, but certainly today she's become a forgotten star of the screen, largely because she chose to end her career mostly in the 1950s and then came out of retirement for you. And that is Elizabeth Scott, who through the 1940s and 1950s was a very prolific star of the screen.
Yes.
and chose to end her career on the screen and end her career as a celebrity entirely in the 1950s as celebrity tabloid magazines were starting to emerge and the Hollywood system was fading away. What made you decide upon putting her in the film?
Well, I mean, the film is partly my meditation upon B movies. When I was a young man, you used to go to the cinema, you had two films. You had the A film and the B film. And I used to love the B films more often than I did the sort of rather overblown A films. So I'd always loved these B films, and they were often very political. And they were often pretty well all in those days in black and white. So it was kind of, I was trying to tip my cap to these films. And of course, Elizabeth Scott was one of those wonderful creatures who appeared on my, you know, the screens of Salisbury, my small town in Wiltshire where I was brought up. And I'd always just loved her. particularly her voice. She had this amazing voice. And she had her hair, which was always parted over. There's another one called Veronica Lake, which had her blonde hair over one eye. So all these images played in my mind. And when we came to cast the film, I asked Michael Klinger, who was in LA, to go and see her because I was concerned that she looked all right and she wasn't, you know. And she was getting on, you know, and we did have a slight confrontation because I was anxious not to hurt her feelings and not to make her look idiotic because she'd gone out with Presley movies and things and she'd been a big star and I didn't want to hurt that image. And I had a rather strange, because I did these film tests, which I don't normally do, because I wanted her to see what she looked like. And I talked to the cameraman and said, I don't want any sort of stockings over the lens to soften the image like they did with Dietrich. We're just a location film. We won't have the time to give that kind of treatment that someone like Sadie did get. So she was horrified by what she looked like. And she flew to Rome because I was, by that time, doing the costumes and things like that. So, and I had this amazing sort of meeting with her in a hotel room where she sat down in front of me and said, right, tell me, Mike, what is it that's wrong with me? And I said, well, it's nothing to do with me. I want you to be happy to know what you'll look like. I said, for example, you've got a vein up in your forehead, which is pulsing. I can see it. You know, I can't turn you into something that you are no longer. So you can imagine it was a very touching, a very sensitive thing for me to have to do, go through. And at the end of it, she said, I want to do it. So I said, if you want to do it, then I would love to have you. So we went together and we worked together and we had a really good relationship, I must say. She was very nervous, of course, but she was fantastic and wonderful to work with.
One of the other, I suppose you could call them rumours, that's been floating around regarding Pulp was that when you were putting Elizabeth Scott on the screen, she was quite nervous, as you've stated, but nervous to the point where you had to cut a lot of her scenes. And I understand that's completely untrue.
Absolutely untrue. No, absolutely. Really, she's just terrific all the way through. Funny, again, another sort of strange rumour, isn't it, that should come out. I don't know where the source is, but they certainly spread quite quickly, even quicker now with social media, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I don't know where the source is for that one. I've seen it reported, but I've never actually seen who actually said that. But
nor do I. But I mean, it's also very strange. The director's usually the last person to know what's going on. The film. Often there are affairs going on, but the director just has no concept until many years afterwards. Sometimes you're talking to a crew member, you discover all sorts of things that were going on because people have a lot of time to waste on when they're making a film. The director's concentrating the whole time on the film itself, but a lot of the periphery people have an enormous amount of time which they're twiddling their thumbs and they get up to all sorts of things. And you find out way after the film is made. I'm still finding out things that happened on Get Carter, for example, that I had no idea were going on.
Director Mike Hodges. Pulp is out now on Blu-ray. Next week, pack your warmest coat. We're off to Iceland for a chat with the director of a chilly new thriller, Rift.
You know that like when you have broken up with somebody and you have to go meet them for some reason and there's like this weird tension in the air? I kind of wanted to like bring that tension into the film.
That's director Erlingur Þóroddsson. We'll also hear from Eliza Hittman about her new Brooklyn-set drama, Beach Rats. That's coming up next week. Today's show was edited and mixed by Christy Evans and researched by Yolene Goffan. I'm Ben Rylan. Thank you for listening.